Case number 23470, Joel Texada versus Andrew Vera et al. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. For appellant, 15 minutes to be shared by appellees. Mr. Dominguez, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Cesar Dominguez on behalf of appellant Joel Texada, and I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The issue before Your Honors today is whether Mr. Texada is a person aggrieved with standing to appeal the Bankruptcy Court's order denying
his 23470, Joel Texada versus Andrew Vera et al. Argument not to
Yes, Your Honor.
Sorry about that. I don't know what that was.
Okay. So should I start over?
Go ahead. The question is whether he's a person aggrieved.
Okay, so the issue before Your Honors today is whether Mr. Texada is a person aggrieved with standing to appeal the Bankruptcy Court's order denying his second motion to vacate order overruling debtor's objection to trustee's notice of intent to sell personal property. Hereinafter,
so, let me ask you, do we even reach person aggrieved? Isn't the real issue here whether there is Article III constitutional standing?
Your Honor, the issue here, as far as my our understanding of the case, is whether he is a person aggrieved. I mean, that's what the argument was about.
Well, the argument is about then prudential standing, but doesn't someone have to have constitutional standing under Article III? And how do you satisfy that?
Well, Your Honor, you know, our focus was on the three-pronged test that this court has provided and the person aggrieved doctrine that has been established by this court. That's the gist of our argument here today.
So how is there a concrete and particularized injury that gives you both a person aggrieved and a constitutional standing?
Well, on the person aggrieved, under the person aggrieved doctrine, we would have to show that the bankruptcy court order adversely diminished the Mr. Texada's property, increases burdens and impaired his rights. So we went through the process of establishing those. Your Honors, in the cases that you have in Marlowe versus Rollins, this court established that if Mr. Texada did not provide the argument in the lower court with regards to the person aggrieved doctrine, that if we were presented to this court at this stage of the game, that if it was presented to you and you saw it, that you could take it up and you would determine whether Mr. Texada does in fact fit the aggrieved person doctrine, the elements of the person aggrieved doctrine.
The reason for the appeal, your client agreed to the revocation of the discharge, did he not?
He did agree, but because we filed a motion to vacate on the grounds of collusion, okay, where we've demonstrated, we've made factual allegations that were not controverted by the Chapter 7 trustee or by the U.S. trustee of all the elements of the person aggrieved doctrine, that basically they've admitted to those factual allegations. So what we have here is a case where the district court, the way the district court dismissed the case, Judge Baker argued that that because Mr. Teixeira did not appeal the actual sale order, that he lacked prudential standing to appeal to appeal pursuant to the under Rule 60B. Well, that's not the sale order is not the order that we appealed in this case. We've appealed the denial of the debtor's second motion to vacate the order, which we did it pursuant.
I have a question.
Yes.
You win this case, what do you want to do if it goes back down to the bankruptcy court? You want to this painting sold, but you couldn't present anybody who would bid more than what was bid in, right?
Well, Your Honor, with the question with the increased burdens on the second factor, when the U.S. trustee filed the adversary complaint against my client, they had to prove that they did not have knowledge of the alleged fraud for their failure to put the painting on the schedules and the state of affairs. But the Simon trustee did in fact, in the creditors meeting, did in fact talk to Mr. Teixeira about the $14 million sale. He talked to him about the liabilities, the $300,000, the $200,000. So he was well aware that he was aware of the Florida litigation. Mr. Teixeira talked to him about the FBI that was involved in the case with all these other cases that it's been going on for the last 20 years. So the trustee was on notice, and the reason why the U.S. trustee decided to enter the agreement with us, with Mr. Teixeira, was that that Mr. Teixeira would not accept that he committed fraud, but rather that Mr. Teixeira understood that if he won the case, then he would not increase his burdens because he would have the discharge. But because he waived the discharge, he put all the creditors back in place. So now he's got over $200,000 in debt. So the answer to your question
is, isn't the law that you cannot manufacture harm? He cannot waive such that he manufactures the harm by inflicting harm on himself. He waived in the situation that you're arguing. He said, all right, I will get rid of my bankruptcy discharge, but now I'm harmed. But a party cannot create concrete and particularized injury to himself by inflicting harm upon himself. I mean, isn't that pretty clear law?
Well, Your Honor, in response to the question is, so if we play out the scenario, so we're in the adversary proceeding, and we're arguing that the U.S. trustee did not meet his burden, that he did not have pre-knowledge of the alleged the fraud that Mrs. Teixeira committed. They were well aware of that. What they could have done is to ask opposing counsel to amend the schedules to include the painting and to put an undetermined amount that is owed.
Yeah, I'm struggling with the options that could have been when the burden here is to show that there's a concrete and particularized injury and that it is likely to be redressed by reversal. And I've not heard what that injury is that is likely to be redressed by reversal. Can you give us that information?
Okay, so the court's three-prong test is whether there was a diminution of the value of the asset, whether the increase of burdens or whether there was the impairment of his rights. Now, it doesn't have to be the three in one. It says or the impairment of its rights. So it could be one of the three. It doesn't have to be the three as far as the read of the three factor test. I would say that the strongest out of the three would be the collusion. Okay, that the impairment of the rights, where the bankruptcy court order basically denied Mr. Teixeira the right to pursue his claims against the trustee, the Chapter 7 trustee, the Florida trustee, and the bad faith purchaser, and because they in his allegations are that they colluded to control and to lower as much as possible the purchase price of the Mr. Teixeira's 25% beneficial interest. That's number one. There was a final judgment of $18.285 million.
I think we're a little, as a final issue, I think isn't there a concern with the speculative nature of your claim, since all of those default judgments, none was ever collected? So don't you have a speculative evidence problem?
Not anymore, Your Honor, because last month, and I did file a motion for judicial notice on this matter, in that the actual painting reverted back to the trust after 8 years of having multiple entities claiming an ownership interest, having liens, encumbrances on the painting. That made it virtually impossible to do any type of sale, to do anything with the painting, because nobody that has $20 million is gonna pay $20 million for a painting when they have four, five, six different entities with liens and encumbrances on the painting. Now that that's removed, now it is, to be honest with you, this painting has an appraised value of $125 million by Professor Mauricio Marini.
And this is why. Counsel, have you ever brought an offer to Mr. Simon?
Initially we did, okay. Initially we did, but at that time there was, with all the complications that were going on, when you still had these entities, people backed out and so there was no firm offer at that point. But Your Honor, the point in this appeal is not that whether this was a good faith sale, and on a good faith sale, you would have the situation where the two exceptions would fit in, where you would say, well, if you don't have the person aggrieved doctrine factors, if you don't have the impairment of his rights, to be more precise with regards to the collusion, then if you don't fit nicely into those three factors, then you have two exceptions. And out of those two exceptions is, if you can show us that upon the sale of the asset, that it would generate a surplus, where you'd be able to pay all the debt that is owed. In this case, it would be $210,000 to $220,000. 25% of 20 million is 5 million. And when you take out the fees and all the other stuff that's going on in Florida, I think that it would end up being around $3 million. So you're looking at a $3 million versus $10,000 of what it was sold for.
Okay, counsel, let me just ask a couple of questions. Yeah. At some point, you agreed that you would either present a buyer for $100,000 or you would agree that your motion to set aside would be denied. Then you came in with a new motion alleging collusion. What changed between the first and second motions?
Okay, what changed is that the Florida trustee filed their billing statements with regards to the amount of work that he's put in, because he's not only the trustee, but he's also the litigator, the attorney for himself. So basically what he was billing the beneficiaries $100,000 for the work that he did for the bad faith purchaser for the $10,000, he billed them over $100,000. So basically he became the de facto attorney for the buyer. So we have a buyer here that Tansip. So we have the bad faith buyer that has counsel, but that counsel is not doing the work, but it's actually the Florida trustee that's doing all the work, and he's billing the beneficiaries for that work. Now he didn't think about
that. Counsel, how does that affect the bankruptcy? How does that show fraud in selling this asset?
Well, the collusion occurred between the Chapter 7 trustee, the bad faith purchaser, and the Florida trustee. So there is, so you have, the question here is whether you have a good faith transaction purchaser, or you either do or you don't, correct? So it was a good transaction or it wasn't a good transaction. Was there a collusion? Collusion is the meaning of the minds. People get together for a common cause and they don't provide this information to the bankruptcy court in this instance. The bankruptcy court didn't put together that, and we didn't find this out until later, that the Florida trustee was billing the beneficiaries for the work that he was doing with, and they did a play by play, day by day, week by week, month to month, showing. And I know that once you get up to the,
okay,
the sale.
Counsel, I'm stopping you. Your time is up. Thank you. You still have your rebuttal.
Yes. Okay.
Thank you. Who's?
Oh, this is Mr. Beyer. I was just waiting for the clerk or the timer to start, but I can go ahead and get started. So Andrew Beyer, may it please the court. On behalf of Appellee Andrew Vara, United States Trustee, Region 9. I just want to start with something that Mr. Dominguez just said, that the question is about whether this was a good faith purchase. That is not the question for this court. That is sort of the merits issue. If Mr. Teixeira had standing to challenge the sale order or the, not the sale order, but the motion to vacate, that would be the question. That's not the question. The question is the threshold question of whether he had standing to appeal the motion to vacate in the first place.
Counsel, how can he, if there's no discharge, how can he not have standing? Because he owes every penny. Right, so it's not a matter that he only benefits if you pay off all the creditors. He's going to be on the hook for everything. So even if this yields 15,000 instead, he benefits.
Well, the sale order itself is a separate order than the discharge, than the waiver of discharge. So the sale order.
We're looking at standing.
Yes.
So we're looking at what is the effect of vacating that sale order. Does he benefit? Does he stand to benefit from it, right?
Yes.
But okay.
We're looking at standing the original. First of all, there's a threshold issue of whether a Rule 60 motion in this case was even appropriate to challenge standing or to challenge the sale order after the fact. The original bankruptcy judge at the time found he did not have standing to challenge the sale because he couldn't provide any proof or any evidence that there was a better offer out there. He failed to appeal that order, that he lacked standing. His Rule 60 motion was challenging the order on the merits. It didn't bring the standing question up, but in any event, he had already failed to appeal that order. So like the district court correctly found that he can't do an end run around that standing decision, his failing to appeal it by bringing a Rule 60 motion. So the waiver of discharge was later after that standing order was, he waived his discharge after the court had already deemed he lacked standing. So he can't come back and try to correct, retroactively create standing for himself by harming himself. So the initially this should be affirmed because he never appealed the standing order in the first place as a procedural matter. But then if you get to the merits of it, like I was saying at the outset, it has nothing to do with whether this was good faith sale. And I just want to point out something else Mr. Dominguez said that's just flat wrong is, I think he said that the allegations of bad faith were undisputed below or uncontroverted. And I would point the court to every single party of this sale filed a reply in response to that, rejecting that the impropriety. There's affidavits in the record. The United States trustee's objection said this is at the record entry 71, page ID 1296-97. It's difficult to conceive how TAMSEF could be anything other than a good faith third party purchaser. The debtor has alleged no facts that would lead a reasonable person to believe otherwise. The chapter 7 trustee's objection, this is at page 1300 to 1302. There could be no more inaccurate characterization of the transaction in question than it being the product of collusion. On the contrary, there were no secrets here. The Florida trustee actually made an appearance just to object to this allegation. And his response is at 1280 to 1284. I have no ownership or beneficial interest in TAMSEF. I have no control over it. I did not.
Counsel, I think we lost you.
Form it. And then the purchaser gave the fact before the filing of the motion, nothing short of egregious. So I just wanted to make sure I firmly rejected that premise that he suggested that there was no sort of, that these facts about good faith were uncontroverted. But you should never even reach that issue because he has no standing to challenge the order itself. And that's under this court's precedent. The person aggrieved standard, Chapter 7 debtors generally do not have standing to appeal because all the estate property goes, all the property goes to the estate, and the estate then, the trustee then administers that property. So whether or not a sale should happen is up to the trustee.
Given this new development, could he bring a motion for new trial and say, look, now I own 25% of this asset? I mean, when you think about it, if it's really worth anything close to what he says it's worth, it does seem like there's something wrong with the result that says he gets credit for $10,000 on a multi-million dollar asset.
Yeah, but there is no real evidence that it's worth anything more than the $10,000 you got. It's a 10% or 25% interest in the asset. He himself could not come up with a better offer, despite multiple opportunities. I think he said that they did come with an offer. I've never seen that in the record, that there was an actual offer.
Counsel, I'm sorry. At the time that he couldn't come up with a better offer, as I understand it, title was not in the trust, right? There was a judgment in favor of the trustee that said it belonged to the trustee, not the trust. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. My screen froze for about 20 seconds there. You were saying at the time of the offer, the title was clouded. I think you were asking a question about that. That's where you cut off. So sorry if you could repeat the question.
Okay, as I understand it, at the time he was attempting to get a better offer, the trust didn't really own the asset. There had been a determination that the trustee, not the trust, owned it. And now that circumstance has changed.
There were a change there. I don't think it was the trustee, but there was, I think the prior purchaser may have still had some potential right to claim some that it could come back and access, or it was clouded by that prior purchase. It was finally resolved earlier this year, as Mr. Dominguez said, but that should have nothing to do with whether in June of 2018, the sale was fair. I mean, that would mean any purchase could come back and get standing by an asset increasing in value. That's why people buy.
Well, I think we lost you again.
Yeah, I think he's.
Council Simon, can you still hear me okay?
Hey, wait.
Mr. Byers?
I froze again. Yes.
Okay.
Here's the concern for me is that at the beginning in this bankruptcy, there was a declaration that this was a valueless earning or owning. Mr. Texera indicated that he had, that this was his father's. And as my understanding of the testimony is that he got in there just to help his father and then found out that it was absolutely worthless and did not put it on his schedules. What role does that play in the claims that are being brought now?
That's what led to his waiver of his discharge. And that's also what gave the trustee initially closed the case, because the Chapter 7 trustee initially closed the case as value as no distribution, because he asked him at the 341 meeting whether this was his, how much it was worth, and Mr. Teixeira didn't disclose it on his petition under penalty of perjury, and did not under oath at the 341 meeting made the disclaimers you just mentioned that it was not worth anything. So it was only after the Chapter 7 trustee got a offer, which he told the potential purchaser, I don't know what I have. He said he doesn't own it. There's all kinds of litigation in Florida. So if you want to pay for it, you take it knowing all with all that knowledge. If that's worth $10,000 to you, then we'll proceed with the sale. Then he reopened the case. And at that point, Mr. Teixeira came forward and said, wait a minute, this is worth way more and it is mine. So that's what led to the adversary complaint to revoke his discharge by the United States Trustee's office. Mm-hmm. And that's why Mr. Teixeira ultimately, through that process, without admitting anything, he ultimately waived his discharge to end that adversary proceeding.
So in light of that adversary proceeding, does Mr. Teixeira have constitutional standing?
I don't believe that changes the standing question. As you mentioned, I don't think he can create standing for himself. And also the issue is the sale order, not the discharge order. And at the time of the sale order, he had not waived his discharge. He did not have standing. He never appealed that order. So, and regarding the $18 million, I just want to point out, as the court has recognized, I think, that is not a real number. That was a judgment in Florida that was always uncollectible. And so it shows nothing. His claims that it's worth $5 million based 25% of $20 million, I don't know where that comes from. That's not in the record other than his assertions. So unless there's any questions from the court, I see my time is up, and I will ask you to affirm the district court's opinion and or order, and turn it over to Mr. Simon. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is David Simon, and I am the Chapter 7 trustee in the bankruptcy case of Joao Teixeira. I'm here this afternoon pro se, and I want to focus primarily on the procedural issues in the bankruptcy case and the allegations that appellant has made with respect to collusion and bad faith in connection with the sale. If there's any bad faith in this case, Your Honors, it lies with the debtor. This case was originally closed as a no asset case. That happened because the debtor did not schedule this asset. And when the debtor was questioned about the asset at his examination at the Section 341 meeting of creditors, he testified that the asset belonged to his father. And in fact, he and his father had the same name. At that point in time, I had no reason to dispute the debtor's testimony under oath.
But counsel, didn't he say that he was part of the litigation too and his dad gave him 25%?
He testified that he was part of the litigation that his father was involved in. That litigation had been pending for upwards of 20 years. There were issues of whether or not the asset of the trust, which is this Caravaggio painting, was even authentic. I did the research I could do to determine that there had never been a determination made on the authenticity of the painting itself. And without a determination of authenticity being made, this asset had no value. And certainly the debtor's 25% interest in his father's interest, if he in fact had such an interest, also had no value. But that wasn't scheduled either. So in any event, the case was closed as a no asset case. Subsequently, I was contacted by counsel in Florida who represented the trustee in the case, who indicated that he had an individual who wanted to buy the debtor's interest in the trust, whatever it may be. I was offered $10,000 for that interest. It was meaningful enough to cause me to seek to reopen the bankruptcy case, an action to which the debtor lodged no objection. Once the bankruptcy case was reopened, I did my notice of intent to sell, and the notice was a notice to sell whatever my interest in this trust would be to TAMSEF. May I proceed for another minute, Your Honor?
Yes.
To TAMSEF LLC for $10,000. The debtor filed an objection to that sale and appeared and argued that there was a buyer out there who might be willing to pay a little bit more, but could produce no one. At that point, Judge Harris overruled the objection to the sale and entered an order authorizing the sale of this asset. Subsequently, there was a first motion to vacate filed. And the result of that motion was an agreed order denying vacation of the sale order because the debtor could not produce the represented $100,000 buyer. Only then did all of this collusion come forward. Your Honors, I've been a bankruptcy trustee for 45 years. I've never, ever been accused of collusion or bad faith in the conduct of the administration of any Chapter 7 bankruptcy case, and it didn't happen here. Everything was done above board. Everything was noticed to the world. The debtor had multiple opportunities to produce a buyer and was unable to do so. And on that basis, I mean, the debtor strikes me as an individual who's killed his parents and now wants orphans benefits. He can't have it both ways. He should have been done when the agreed order was entered denying his motion to vacate the sale the first time around.
Okay.
I wonder how many bites at the apple does he get?
Counsel, let's say in 5 months that painting is sold for $15 million. I mean, what does that say about these proceedings?
Nothing. Hindsight is always 20/20, Your Honor. I mean, the finality happens sometime. And there is no evidence in the record today, let alone 2 years ago, that would suggest that the painting is worth $10 million or $15 million or the $3 million net that Mr. Dominguez argued. Nobody has a crystal ball. I certainly don't in the administration of a Chapter 7 case. I have to administer my cases based on the facts as they exist in the present. That's my obligation for the benefit of creditors.
And he has not brought you any buyers for...
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
He never brought you any buyers for more than 10,000.
He represented, in the context of our agreement on the first motion to vacate, that within 30 days, he would bring a buyer for $100,000, or he would consent to an order denying his motion to vacate. That buyer did not come forth.
Okay. All right.
So I would also ask the court to affirm the lower court's opinions. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Dominguez.
So in their arguments to this court, Mr. Baer and Mr. Simon stated that Mr. Teixeira should have appealed the sale order, that that's what he was supposed to do, that that's what took away the prudential standing. However, when you read Mr. Baer's answer brief to this court and you look at the statement of appellate jurisdiction, I will quote, it says, the district court had jurisdiction to hear the appeal under Title 28 U.S.C. Sections 158A1 and C1A, which confers jurisdiction on the district courts to hear appeals from final judgments, orders, and decrees of bankruptcy judges. But the district court lacked jurisdiction to review the underlying sale order or any other final order entered prior to April 5th, 2019, the second motion to vacate, because Mrs. Teixeira did not timely appeal those orders or file a timely motion under Federal Rule Bankruptcy Procedure 8002B to preserve his ability to appeal any of those orders. So what's happening here is that he's talking out of two sides of his mouth. On the one hand, he says that he comes to this court and he tells this court that Mr. Teixeira should have appealed the sale order, that that's what he was supposed to do. And then he puts in his brief that's not what he was supposed to do because Judge Baker had lacked jurisdiction to review the underlying sale order because it wasn't brought up to Judge Baker pursuant to the Title 28 U.S.C. Section 158A1. So that in itself was an erroneous ruling by the district court. It lacked jurisdiction to entertain the sale order. In addition to the sale order, it wasn't even in the sale order. It was in the transcript of the hearing on the objection to the sale. It wasn't even entered as an actual order. So there are some contradictions on behalf of the U.S. trustee and the Simon trustee who made it a point in his whole brief to side with Judge Baker that Teixeira lacked prudential standing because he didn't appeal a sale order, which is directly contradicted by the statement of appellate jurisdiction that Mr. Baer filed in the district court as well. It's there, just like it's in this court. He did the same thing in the district court. I wasn't able to tell you that because there was a lot of back and forth and the questions that Your Honors had for me, but that's where we stand on that issue. With regards to the other issue, Your Honors, that on the exceptions to the person aggrieved doctrine, which is the if there's a sale, if there's a sale that could occur where let's say that it's sold in the, let's say within this month that it's sold for $20 million. And then I come back to this court and I file a notice with this court that there's a sale pending in Florida for the purchase of this painting for $20 million. Wouldn't that be something that this court would entertain and say now there's no longer a remote possibility that there's a sale and we can avoid going through the person aggrieved factors and get right to it if there is money on the table for the purchase of this painting? That would that be something that your honors would consider and say, okay, well, this is no longer some remote possibility. Now this is a reality. Now there's money in a trust account for the purchase of this painting. Now
here's the concern, part of the concern for me is that all of this background history about this painting was known when Mr. Texera filed bankruptcy, and he didn't list it. And then when asked about it, he denied that it was of any value. And then he said he would find somebody, then after it was going to be sold, after he had been outside bankruptcy and someone else came in, he said, well, I can get somebody to pay a little bit more for it. And I agree that you will deny my motion if I don't bring them by X date. And then X date comes and you don't show up at the hearing. My question also is, how does finality fit in any of these arguments? Because it seems that every time there is a next step that's a possibility based on a previous denial. And I'm struggling with that kind of record. What is your response to why it was never listed to begin with?
Well, Your Honor, to begin again, the district court erred in looking at the sale order, because the sale order is not under appeal. What's under appeal is a second motion to vacate the sale order based on collusion and all the other elements that we've cited. The exception to that would be if there's a buyer that we could bring and there's a surplus that this could all just go away.
That doesn't answer my question as to why it was not listed to begin with.
Well, there was extensive conversations about this painting. It wasn't like Mr. Simon was.
I'm asking about what did he list to begin with before the court even found out about this? He did not list it in his bankruptcy.
Your Honor, there was a previous counsel in this case. I wasn't his attorney at the creditors meeting. But what I can say is that Mr. Simon had enough information. He knew about the litigation. He read one of my motions that against the Florida trustee accusing him of all kinds of things in Florida. So he knew that this was extensive litigation between the parties. He knew that the Florida trustee had been in litigation for the last 20 years. He knew or should have known that no one's going to fight for a painting that's worth $10,000 for 20 years. He knew that there was a problem, that there was a big problem here, and he didn't investigate it. He didn't go further. He talked to the trustee. Oh, we don't even know what that's worth. We don't even know who owns it. It's not clear about the forensics. Okay,
that's an adequate answer to my question. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you all. The case will be submitted.